There are probably a few projects you can think of right now, off the top of your head, that you know you want to get more objectified, fleshed out, and under control. Perhaps you have an important meeting coming up, and you know you have to prepare an agenda and materials for it. Or you've just inherited the job of coordinating the annual associates conference, and you've got to get it organized as soon as possible so you can start delegating significant pieces. Or you need to think about and handle plans for an upcoming holiday with your family. If you haven't done it already, get a next action now that will start the planning process for each of these and put it on the appropriate action list. Then proceed with further planning steps. Typical planning steps. The most common types of planning-oriented actions will be your own brainstorming and organizing, setting up meetings, and gathering information. Brainstorming. Some of the projects that have your attention right now will require you to do your own free-form thinking. This is especially true of those for which you were not clear about what the next action would be when you made that decision. These should all have a next action, such as draft ideas regarding X. You need to decide where and how you want to do that action in order to know which action list to put it on. Do you do this kind of thinking best on a computer or by handwriting your thoughts on paper? I may choose either medium depending on what my intuition tells me. For me, this next action would go either on my at-computer list or on anywhere, because I can draw mind maps or take rough notes wherever I am as long as I have pen and paper. Organizing. You may have some projects for which you have already collected notes and miscellaneous support materials, and you just need to sort through them and get them into a more structured form. In this case, your next action would likely be organize Project X notes. If you have to be in your office to do that, because that's where the files are and you don't want to carry them around, that action should go on your at-office action list. If you're carrying the project notes around with you in a folder or in some digital device, then the organize action would go on an anywhere action list if you're going to do it by hand, or on at-computer if you're going to use a word processing or outlining program, or presentation, mind mapping, or project planning software. Setting up meetings. Often the next progress to be made on project thinking is to set up a meeting with the people you'd like to have involved in the brainstorming and or decision making. That usually means sending an email to the whole group or to an assistant to get it calendared, or making a phone call to the primary person to nail down a day and time. Gathering information. Sometimes the next task on project thinking is to gather more data. Maybe you need to talk to someone to get his or her input. Call Bill regarding his thoughts on the manager's meeting. Or you need to look through the files you just inherited from last year's conference. Review associate conference archive files. Or you want to surf the web to get a sense of what's happening out there on a new topic you're exploring. Look into college scholarship funds. Random project thinking. Don't lose any ideas about projects that could potentially be useful. Many times you'll think of something you don't want to forget when you're in a place that has nothing to do with the project. You're driving to the store, for example, and you think of a great way to start off the next staff meeting. Or you're stirring the spaghetti sauce in the kitchen, and it occurs to you that you might want to give out nice tote bags to participants in the upcoming conference. Or you're watching the evening news when you suddenly remember another key person you may want to include in the advisory council you're putting together. If these aren't specifically next actions that can go directly on your action lists, you'll still need to capture and organize them somewhere that makes sense. Of course, the most critical tool for ensuring that nothing gets lost is your collection system, your in-tray, pen and paper, or smartphone. You need to hold all your ideas until you later decide what to do with them. Tools and structures that support project thinking. No matter at what level project ideas show up, it's great to have good tools always close at hand for capturing them as they occur. Once they've been captured, it's useful to have access to them whenever you need to refer to them. Thinking tools. One of the great secrets to getting ideas and increasing your productivity is utilizing the function follows form phenomenon. Great tools can trigger good thinking. I've come up with some of my most productive thoughts when simply exploring a new software application that created an interesting or fun way to generate and capture data. If you aren't writing anything down or inputting into a digital device, it's extremely difficult to stay focused on anything for more than a few minutes, especially if you're by yourself. But when you utilize physical tools to keep your thinking anchored and saved, you can stay engaged constructively for hours. Writing instruments. Keep good writing tools around all the time so you never have any unconscious resistance to thinking due to not having anything to capture it with. If I don't have something to write with, or text or type into, I know I'm not as comfortable letting myself think progressively about projects and situations. Conversely, I've done some great thinking and planning at times just because I wanted to use my great-feeling, smooth-writing fountain or gel pen. You may not be inspired by cool gear like I am, but if you are, do yourself a favor and invest in quality writing tools. I also suggest that you keep nice pens at each of the stations where you're likely to want to take notes, at your desks, in the kitchen, in your briefcases, satchels, purses, and backpacks. Paper and pads. In addition to writing tools, you should always have their functional equivalent, pads of paper, close at hand. Perforated paper is preferable to solid notebooks because you want to be able to tear off pages with ideas and notes and toss them into your in tray until you get a chance to process them. Also, you may find it valuable to keep some of your early and informal jotted mind maps and notes, original or scanned, in appropriate files. The handwritten trails often contain rich context memory jogs that prove valuable later on. Easels and whiteboards. If you have room for them, whiteboards and/or easel pads are very functional thinking tools to use from time to time. They give you plenty of space on which to jot down ideas, and it can be useful to keep them up in front of you for a while as you incubate on a topic. Whiteboards are great to have on a wall in your office and in meeting rooms, and the bigger the better. Some companies have designed whole internal walls as erasable writing surfaces, fostering brainstorming and ad hoc visual communications. If you have children, I recommend that you install one in their bedrooms. I wish I had grown up with the encouragement to have as many ideas as I could. Be sure to keep plenty of fresh markers on hand. Nothing stifles creative thinking faster than dry and useless writing tools. Whenever two or more people are gathered for a meeting, someone should start writing somewhere where the others can see. Even if you erase the thoughts after a few minutes, just the act of writing them down facilitates a constructive thinking process like nothing else. I've found it immensely helpful at times to draw informal diagrams and notes on paper tablecloths, placemats, or even napkins in restaurants if I didn't have my own pad of paper at hand. Thinking in your digital tools. Many times I like to think on my laptop and, less frequently, on my tablet. Within my word processing, mind mapping, outlining, presentation, or spreadsheet programs. There are so many things I might want to do later on with my thinking, and it feels terrific to already have it in some digital form for later editing and cutting and pasting into various other applications. Once I've booted up and the screen is ready in front of me, I find that thinking just automatically starts to happen. This is another good reason to ensure that your typing and keyboard skills are sufficient to make engaging with the computer at least easy, if not downright fun. Just as larger whiteboards facilitate more creative connections and expanded thought horizons, I have found that larger and additional computer screens provide a similar usefulness. As the world has rapidly become both digital and mobile, people have understandably experienced a tremendous increase in access and efficiency with their ever smaller devices. I suggest, however, that the value of smartphones and the like is for the execution of the results of thinking, not for generating creative thought. For that, I want more space, not less. A great use of the camera function in smartphones is to snap pictures of whiteboard and easel pad thinking so that it can be erased for further brainstorming and the results channeled back to the participants for whatever use they might want to make of it. The support structures. In addition to good tools ubiquitously at hand, it is productive to have accessible formats into which project thinking can be captured. Much as a good pen and paper in front of you support brainstorming, having good tools and places for organizing project details facilitates the more linear planning that many projects need. Create file folders or loose leaf pages as needed. A good general reference filing system, right at hand and easy to use, is not only critical to manage the general workflow process, but highly functional for project thinking as well. Often a project begins to emerge when it's triggered by relevant data, notes, and miscellaneous materials, and for this reason, you'll want to create a folder for a topic as soon as you have something to put in it. If your filing system is too formal or non-existent, you'll probably miss many opportunities to generate a project focus sufficiently early. As soon as you return from that first meeting with your initial notes about a topic that has just emerged on the horizon, create a file and store them in it right away, after you have gleaned any next actions, of course. Many times, while coaching clients, I find that the mere act of creating a file for a topic into which we can organize random notes and potentially relevant materials gives them a significantly improved sense of control. It's a way of physically, visibly, and psychologically getting their arms around it. If you like to work with a loose-leaf notebook or planner, it's good to keep an inventory of fresh notepaper or graph paper that you can use to set up a page on a theme or project as it shows up. While some projects may later deserve a whole tabbed section or even an entire notebook of their own, they don't start out that way. And most of your projects may need only a page or two to hold the few ideas you need to track. Paper versus digital. For those who have become increasingly digitally oriented, it is tempting to try to eliminate paper altogether. Theoretically, that shouldn't be a problem, with all the digital note-taking, scanning, and character recognition tools available. In practice, however, paper still provides high value for most of us. Handwritten note-taking is not going away, for multiple reasons, not the least of which is the universality of the tools and the range of graphic representations available. We tend to think differently when we express with different equipment, and many people find that writing and drawing by hand unwraps a broader palette of ideas. Also, paper-based materials allow us to be reminded of information, relationships, and perspectives more readily than what we can see at any one time on a computer screen. I personally know of many digitally savvy people who have returned to using paper planners and notebooks because they found them easier to use to coordinate their own thinking and reminders. Many times, I will print documents related to a person, project, or topic, which I then hold in a physical file folder to use in a meeting or for my own writing and research. Though much of that paper will be recycled and the updated information returned to a digital home, the physical materials in the interim serve a function of which the computer by itself is still incapable. Digital technology will undoubtedly continue to emerge, which will contribute vastly to thinking, planning, and decision support in ways that low-tech materials and tools cannot. But until pens, notepads, post-its, physical folders, and printed documents can be replaced by something better, they will still need to play some part in your coordinated personal management system. What if paper was just discovered? Wow, something that allows you a visual map of your digital information, which you can manipulate and communicate physically and visually, and something that can capture, facilitate, and share creative thinking without batteries or electricity. Wow! Software tools. I have yet to discover any one perfect project management tool. The plethora of applications that purport to serve that function are usually either too high-powered or too simplistic for what most of us need to manage. And as I've noted, I have never seen any two projects that needed the same amount of detailing and structure to get them under control. So it would be difficult to create any one application that would suffice for the majority. The rest of us usually find bits and pieces of applications more informal and project-friendly. That said, there are multiple kinds of digital tools that can be extremely useful. Most professionals are familiar with word processing programs, spreadsheets, and presentation programs, any of which might be the optimal way to structure project plans or portions thereof, especially once the purpose, vision, and brainstorming phases have been handled. The two types of software that tend to be more useful for informal planning and brainstorming are mind mapping and outlining applications. I personally use a digital mind mapping tool for most all of my projects as a way both to do focused brainstorming and to capture random thoughts about the projects as they show up ad hoc. In most cases, the final mind map itself is sufficient organization for me to feel comfortable that I have the project under control. Another option for brainstorming is an outlining program, which allows the creation of headings and subheadings in limited or expanded detail. Most good word processing programs also provide this functionality. The nice thing about these programs is that they can handle a wide range of complexity, from the simplest few bullet points about organizing a party to generating the structure for a whole book you're writing. Though outlining and word processing programs tend to support more structured thinking, because of the ease of cutting, pasting, and rearranging text in the digital world, they still allow for plenty of creative thought development. On the high end of the spectrum is complex project management software. Professionals and organizations that have very specific needs for which the rigor and details managed by those applications are required usually have and use these tools already in order to function. And they are most often customized for company-specific projects. This is the software that is used to launch Mars probes, coordinate building construction, and deliver airplanes and pharmaceuticals. On the lowest end of the digital project management scale is jotting ideas in the notes section of a task item that lists one of your projects, or using generic note generating and organizing software, creating a note for a project with its associated thoughts. If you are computer savvy, you will no doubt use several of these modalities for developing and capturing project plans and collateral material. Make sure you create comfort with the applications so you can focus more on your project thinking than on the software. It will also behoove you to do regular reviews and updating of this content wherever it is and keep it current with consistent purging and reorganizing. Remember that the computer is a bit of a black hole, and as memory and storage capacity continue to expand and new cool applications for pieces of this functionality continue to proliferate, it becomes easier to keep everything and then lose a coordinated orientation of your active stuff. How do I apply all this in my world? Just as your next actions list needs to be up to date, so too does your projects list. That done, give yourself a block of time, ideally between 1 and 3 hours, to handle as much of the vertical thinking about each project as you can. At the very least, right now or as soon as possible, take those few of your projects that you have the most attention on or interest in right now and do some thinking, collecting, and organizing on them, using whatever tools seem most appropriate. Focus on each, one at a time, top to bottom. As you do, ask yourself, what about this do I want to know, capture, or remember? You may just want to mind map some thoughts on a piece of paper, make a file, and toss the paper into it. You may come up with some simple bullet point headings to attach as a note in your digital mobile organizer, or you could create a word processing document and start an outline on it. The key is to get comfortable with having and using your ideas, and to acquire the habit of focusing your energy constructively on intended outcomes and open loops before you have to. Part 3. The Power of the Key Principles. Chapter 11. The Power of the Capturing Habit. There's much more to these simple techniques and models than may appear at first glance. Indeed, they offer a systematic method to keep your mind distraction-free, ensuring a high level of efficiency and effectiveness in your work. That in itself would be sufficient reason to implement these practices. But there are even greater implications for the fundamental principles at work here. What follows in the next 3 chapters is an accounting of my experience over the past 30 years of the subtler and often more profound effects that can transpire from the implementation of these basic principles. The longer-term results can have a significant impact on you as an individual, and they can positively affect larger organizational cultures as well. When people with whom you interact notice that without fail you receive, process, and organize in an airtight manner the exchanges and agreements they have with you, they begin to trust you in a unique way. More significantly, you incorporate a level of self-confidence in your engagement with your world that money cannot buy. Such is the power of capturing placeholders for anything that is incomplete or unprocessed in your life. It noticeably enhances your mental well-being and improves the quality of your communications and relationships, both personally and professionally. And when organizations expect and reinforce this best practice of allowing nothing to fall through a communication crack, with everyone accountable for resulting actions, and commitments clarified and tracked by the appropriate persons, it can significantly increase a culture's productivity and reduce its stress. The personal benefit. How did it feel to go through the collecting and downloading activity? Most people say it feels so bad and yet so good. How can that be? If you're like most people who go through the full capturing process, you probably felt some form of anxiety. Descriptive terms like overwhelmed, panic, frustration, fatigue, and disgust tend to come up when I ask seminar participants to describe their emotions in going through a minor version of this procedure. And is there anything you think you've procrastinated on in that stack? If so, you have guilt automatically associated with it. I could have, should have, ought to have done this before now. At the same time, did you experience any sense of release or relief or control as you did the drill? Most people say yes, indeed. How does that happen? Totally opposite emotional states showing up as you're doing a single exercise, almost at the same time. Anxiety and relief, overwhelmed and in control. What's going on here? When you understand the source of your negative feelings about all your stuff, you'll discover, as I did, the way to get rid of them. And if you experienced any positive feelings from collecting your stuff, you actually began the process of eliminating the negativity yourself. The source of the negative feelings. Where do the not-so-good feelings come from? Too much to do? No, there's always too much to do. If you felt bad simply because there was more to do than you could do, you'd never get rid of that feeling. Having too much to do is not the source of the negative feeling. It comes from a different place. How have you felt when someone broke an agreement with you, told you they would meet you Thursday at 4 p.m. and never showed or called? How did that feel? Frustrating, I imagine. The price people pay when they break an agreement in the world is the disintegration of trust in the relationship, an automatic negative consequence. But what are all those things in your in-tray? Agreements you've made or at least implicitly accepted with yourself, things you somehow have told yourself you should deal with in some way. Your negative feelings are simply the result of breaking those agreements. They're the symptoms of disintegrated self-trust. If you tell yourself to draft a strategic plan, when you don't do it, you feel bad. Tell yourself to get organized, and if you fail to, welcome to guilt and frustration. Resolve to spend more time with your kids, and then don't. Voila, anxious and overwhelmed. How do you prevent broken agreements with yourself? If the negative feelings come from broken agreements, you have three options for dealing with them and eliminating the negative consequences. First, don't make the agreement. Second, complete the agreement. Or third, renegotiate the agreement. All of these can work to get rid of the unpleasant feelings. Don't make the agreement. It probably felt pretty good to take a bunch of your old stuff, decide that you weren't going to do anything with it, and just shred, recycle, or toss it into the trash. One way to handle an incompletion in your world is to just say no. You'd lighten up a lot if you would just lower your standards. If you didn't care so much about things being up to a certain level, your parenting, your school system, your team's morale, the software code, you'd have fewer things to do or have attention on. It has been a popular concept in the self-help world that focusing on your values will simplify your life. I contend the opposite. The overwhelming amount of things that people have to do comes from their values. Values are critical elements for meaning and direction and decision-making, but don't kid yourself. The more you focus on them, the more things you're likely to feel responsible for taking action on. Your values make it easier for you to make choices, but don't think they will make things any simpler. I doubt you're going to lower your standards, but once you really understand the consequences, you'll probably make fewer agreements. I know I did. I used to make a lot of them just to win people's approval. When I realized the price I was paying on the back end for not keeping those agreements, I became a lot more conscious about the ones I made. One insurance executive I worked with described the major benefit he derived from implementation of this system. He said, "Previously, I would just tell everyone, 'Sure, I'll do it,' because I didn't know how much I really had to do. Now that I've got the inventory clear and complete, just to maintain my integrity, I have to say, 'No, I can't do that. I'm sorry.' The amazing thing is that instead of being upset with my refusal, everyone was impressed with my discipline." Another client, an entrepreneur in the personal coaching business, recently told me that making an inventory of his work had eliminated a huge amount of worry and stress from his life. The discipline of putting everything he had his attention on into his in-tray caused him to reconsider what he really wanted to do anything about. If he wasn't willing to toss a note about it into in, he just let it go. I consider that very mature thinking. One of the best things about this whole method is that when you really take on the responsibility to capture and track what's on your mind, you'll think twice about making commitments internally that you don't really need or want to make. In my many years of working with people to get their list of projects clear and current, every single person has decided that something was not worth doing that they thought they were committed to. Not being aware of all you have to do is much like having a credit card for which you don't know the balance or the limit. It's a lot easier to be careless with your commitments. Complete the agreement. Of course, another way to get rid of the negative feelings about your stuff is to just finish it and be able to mark it off as done. You actually love to do things as long as you get the feeling that you've completed something. If you've begun to take less than 2-minute actions as they surface in your life, I'm sure you can attest to the psychological benefit. Most people I work with feel fantastic after just a couple of hours of processing their piles, simply because of how many things they accomplish using the 2-minute rule. One of your better weekends may be spent just finishing up a lot of little errands and tasks that have accumulated around your house and in your personal life. Invariably, when you capture all the open loops, little and big, and see them on a list in front of you, some part of you will be inspired or creatively disgusted or intimidated enough to go knock them off the list. We all seem to be starved for a win. It's great to satisfy that by giving yourself doable tasks you can start and finish easily. Have you ever completed something that wasn't initially on a list, so you wrote it down and checked it off? Then you know what I mean. There's another issue here, however. How would you feel if your list and your stack were totally and successfully completed? You'd probably be bouncing off the ceiling, full of creative energy. Of course, within 3 days, if not 3 minutes, guess what you'd have? Right, another list, and probably an even bigger one, with more potentially daunting things to do on it. You'd feel so good about finishing all your stuff, you'd likely take on bigger, more ambitious things to do. Not only that, but if you have a boss or a board, what do you think he or she or they are going to do after noticing the high levels of competency and productivity you're demonstrating? Right again. Give you more things to do. It's the irony of professional development. The better you get, the better you'd better get. So, since you're not going to significantly lower your standards or stop creating more things to do, you'd better get comfortable with the third option if you want to keep from being stressed out. Renegotiate the agreement. Suppose I'd told you I would meet you Thursday at 4 p.m., but after I made the appointment, my world changed. Now, given my new priorities, I decide I'm not going to meet you Thursday at 4. But instead of simply not showing up, what had I better do to maintain the integrity of the relationship? Correct. Call and change the agreement. A renegotiated agreement is not a broken one. Do you understand yet why getting all your stuff out of your head and in front of you makes you feel better? Because you automatically renegotiate your agreements with yourself when you look at them, think about them, and either act on them that very moment or say, no, not now. Here's the problem. It's impossible to renegotiate agreements with yourself that you can't remember you made. The fact that you can't remember an agreement you made with yourself doesn't mean that you're not holding yourself liable for it. Ask any psychologist how much of a sense of past and future that part of your psyche has, the part that was storing the list you dumped. Zero. It's all present tense in there. That means that as soon as you tell yourself that you should do something, if you file it only in your short-term memory, that part of you thinks you should be doing it all the time. And that means that as soon as you've given yourself two things to do and filed them only in your head, you've created instant and automatic stress and failure because you can't do them both at once. And that apparently significant part of your psyche will continue to hold you accountable. If you're like most people, you've probably got some storage area at home, maybe a basement that you told yourself a while back, maybe even 10 years ago, you ought to clean and organize. If so, there's a part of you that likely thinks you should have been cleaning your basement 24 hours a day for the past 10 years. No wonder people are so tired. And have you heard that little voice inside your own mental committee every time you walk by that area? Why are we walking by the basement? Aren't we supposed to be cleaning it? Because you can't stand that whining, nagging part of yourself, you never even go into that area anymore if you can help it. If you want to shut that voice up, you have three options for dealing with your agreement with yourself. 1. Lower your standards about your garage. You may have done that already. So I have a crappy garage. Who cares? 2. Keep the agreement. Clean the garage. 3. At least put clean garage on a someday maybe list. Then, when you review that list weekly and you see that item, you can tell yourself, not this week. The next time you walk by your garage, you won't hear a thing internally other than, ha, not this week. I'm quite sincere about this. It seems that there's a part of our consciousness that doesn't know the difference between an agreement about cleaning the basement and an agreement about buying a company or improving our personal finances. In there, they're all just agreements, kept or broken. If you're holding something only internally, it will be a broken agreement if you're not moving on it in the moment. The radical departure from traditional time management. This method is significantly different from traditional time management training. Most of those models leave you with the impression that if something you tell yourself to do isn't that important, it's not worth it to track, manage, or deal with. But in my experience, that's inaccurate, at least in terms of how a less-than-conscious part of us operates. It is how our conscious mind operates, however, so every agreement must be made conscious. That means it must be captured, clarified, and reviewed objectively and regularly in full conscious awareness so that you can put it where it belongs in your self-management arena. If that doesn't happen, it will actually take up a lot more of your internal energy than it deserves. In my experience, anything that is held only in your head will take up either more or less attention than it deserves. The reason to collect everything is not that everything is equally important. It's that it's not. Incompletions, uncaptured, take on a dull sameness in the sense of the pressure they create and the attention they tie up. How much capturing is required? You'll feel better collecting anything that you haven't captured yet. When you say to yourself, "Oh, that's right, I need to get butter the next time I'm at the store," and you write it on your grocery list, you'll feel better. When you remember, "I've got to call my financial advisor about the trust fund," and you write that down someplace where you know you'll see it when you have a phone and time, you'll feel better. But there's still a light years difference when you know you have it all. When will you know how much you have left in your head to capture? Only when there's nothing left. If some part of you is even vaguely aware that you don't have it all, you can't really know what percentage you have collected. How will you know when there's nothing left? When nothing else shows up as a reminder in your mind. This doesn't mean that your mind will be empty. If you're conscious, your mind will always be focusing on something. But if it's focusing on only one thing at a time, without distraction, you'll be in your zone. I suggest that you use your mind to think about things rather than think of them. You want to be adding value as you think about projects and situations, not creating stress by simply reminding yourself they exist and you need to do something about them. To fully realize that more productive place, you will need to capture it all. It takes focus and a change of habit to train yourself to recognize and download even the smallest agreements with yourself as they're created in your mind. Doing the capturing process as fully as you can, and then incorporating the behavior of gathering all the new things as they emerge, will be more empowering and productive than you can imagine. When relationships and organizations have the capture habit. What happens when everyone involved on a team, in a marriage, in a department, on a staff, in a family, in a company, can be trusted not to let anything slip through the cracks. Frankly, once you've achieved that, you'll hardly think about whether people are dropping the ball anymore. There will be much bigger and better things to occupy your attention. But if communication gaps are still an issue, there's likely some layer of frustration and a general nervousness in the relationship or the culture. Most people feel that without constant babysitting and hand-holding, things could disappear in the system and then blow up at any time. They don't realize that they're feeling this because they've been in this situation so consistently that they relate to it as if it were a permanent law like gravity. It doesn't have to be that way. I've noticed this for years. Good people who haven't incorporated these behaviors come into my environment, and they stick out like a sore thumb. I've lived with the standards of a clear head and hard, clean edges on in-trays for more than 3 decades now. When a note sits idle in someone's in-tray unprocessed, or when he or she nods, "Yes, I will," in a conversation but doesn't otherwise capture that in some way, my uh-oh bell rings. This is unacceptable behavior in my world. There are much bigger fish to fry than worrying about leaks in the system. I need to trust that any request or relevant information I put in an email, on a voicemail, in a conversation, or in a written note will get into the other person's system and that it will be processed and organized soon and available for his or her review as an option for action. If the recipient is managing voicemails but not email and paper, I have now been hamstrung to use only his or her trusted medium. That should be unacceptable behavior in any organization that cares about whether things happen with the least amount of effort. When change is required, there must be trust that the initiatives for that change will be dealt with appropriately. Any intact system will ultimately be only as good as its weakest link, and often that Achilles heel is a key person's dulled responsiveness to communications in the system. I especially notice this when I walk around organizations where in-trays are either non-existent or overflowing and obviously long unprocessed. These cultures usually suffer from serious interruptitis because they can't trust putting communications into the system. I come across executives whose calendars are insanely overbooked, but who, when they begin to give timely responses to their emails, experience a dramatic relief from that pressure. When their staff and others are getting what they need in terms of appropriate feedback and decisions through that virtual medium, they no longer need the kind of face-to-face time they previously tried to get with meetings. Where cultures do have solid systems, down through the low-tech level of paper communications, the clarity is palpable. It's hardly even a conscious concern, and everyone's attention is more focused. The same is true in families that have installed in-trays. The parents, the children, the nanny, the housekeeper, or anyone else with whom family members frequently interact. People often grimace when I tell them that my wife and I put things in each other's in-trays, even when we're sitting within a few feet of each other. To them, it seems cold and mechanical. Aside from being an act of politeness intended to avoid interrupting the other's work in progress, the practice actually fosters more warmth and freedom between us because mechanical things are being handled in the system instead of tying up our attention on the relationship. Unfortunately, you can't legislate personal systems. Everyone must have his or her own way to deal with what he or she has to deal with. You can, however, hold people accountable for outcomes and for tracking and managing everything that comes their way, and you can give them the information in this book. Then, at least, they'll have no excuse for letting something fall through the cracks. This doesn't mean that everyone has to do everything. I hope I have described a way to relate to our knowledge-based world that provides room for everyone to have a lot more to do than he or she can do. The critical issue will be to facilitate a constant renegotiation process with all involved, so they feel okay about what they're not doing. That's real knowledge work at a more sophisticated level. But there's little hope of getting there without having bulletproof capture systems in play. Remember, you can't renegotiate an agreement with yourself that you can't remember you made. And you certainly can't renegotiate agreements with others that you and they have lost track of. When groups of people collectively adopt the 100% capture standard, they have a tight ship to sail. It doesn't mean they're sailing in the right direction, or even that they're on the right ship. It just means that the one they're on, in the direction it's going, is sailing with the most efficient energy it can. Chapter 12. The power of the next action decision. I have a personal mission to make what's the next action part of our global thought process. I envision a world in which no meeting or discussion will end and no interaction cease without a clear indication of whether or not some action is needed, and if it is, what it will be, or at least who has accountability for it. I envision organizations adopting a standard that anything that lands in anyone's field of awareness will be evaluated for action required and the resulting decisions managed appropriately. Imagine the freedom that would provide for people and organizations to focus their attention on bigger issues and opportunities. Over the years, I have noticed an extraordinary shift in energy and productivity whenever individuals and groups installed "What's the next action?" as a fundamental and consistently asked question. As simple as the query seems, it is still somewhat rare to find it fully operational where it needs to be. One of the greatest challenges you may encounter is that once you have gotten used to what's the next action for yourself and those around you, interacting with people who aren't asking it can be highly frustrating. It clarifies things so quickly that dealing with people and environments that don't use it can seem nightmarish. We are all accountable for defining what, if anything, we are committed to make happen as we engage with others and ourselves. And at some point, for any outcome that we have an internal commitment to complete, we must make the decision about the next physical action required. There's a great difference, however, between making that decision when things show up and doing it when they blow up. The source of the technique. I learned this simple but extraordinary next action technique more than 30 years ago from a longtime friend and management consultant mentor of mine, Dean Acheson. No relation to the former U.S. Secretary of State. Dean had spent many prior years consulting with executives and researching what was required to free up the log jams many of them had regarding projects and situations they were involved in order to release and galvanize energy for significant change required in their organizations. One day, he just started picking up each individual piece of paper on an executive's desk and forcing him to decide what the very next thing was that he had to do to move it forward. The results were so immediate and so profound for the executive that Dean continued for years to perfect a methodology using that same question to process the entry. Since then, given what I've developed using Dean's insights, hundreds of thousands of people have been trained and coached with this key concept, and it remains a foolproof technique. This thought process is not something we're born doing, nor does it seem to come to us naturally. When you were born, it probably didn't occur to you to ask your mother, "So what are we doing here, and what's the next action, and who has it?" It is a learned technique of thinking, decision-making, and consciously directed focus. It will happen automatically for you when the situation obviously demands it, as in a crisis, or when the pressure in a situation, from the boss, a client, your child, or the unexpected circumstance, forces a next action decision to avert painful consequences. But incorporating this as a proactive behavior, before the circumstances are so obvious and action so immediately necessary, is an acquired practice. I am tempted but hesitant to use the word skill in this case. We all already have the ability to make a next action decision. We do it all the time, thousands of times a day, but mostly unconsciously. Yet making that decision before we have to about things we're committed to move on is a powerful and elegant cognitive behavior pattern that can be learned, practiced, and integrated. It is a core element of knowledge work athletics. And most people don't do it in that manner about even the most important things in their lives. Making it a part of your personal and organizational life never fails to improve both your productivity and peace of mind. Creating the option of doing. How could something so simple be so powerful? What's the next action? To help answer that question, I invite you to revisit for a moment your mind sweep list, refer to Chapter 5, or at least to think about all the projects that are probably sitting around in your head. Do you have a sense that any of them haven't been moving along as consistently and productively as they could be? You'll probably admit yes, indeed, a few have been a little bit stuck. If you haven't known for sure whether you needed to make a call, send an email, talk to someone, surf the web about something, or buy an item at the store as the very next thing to move on, it hasn't been getting done. What's ironic is that it would likely require only about 10 seconds of thinking to figure out what the next action would be for almost everything on your list. But it's 10 seconds of thinking and decision-making that most people haven't done about most things on their lists. For example, someone will have something like tires on a list. I then ask, "What's that about?" He responds, "Well, I need new tires on my car." "So what's the next action?" At that point, he usually wrinkles up his forehead, ponders for a few moments, and expresses his conclusion. "Well, I need to check the web for stores and prices for the tires." That's about how much time and cognitive investment is required to decide what the doing would look like on almost everything. It's just the few seconds of focused thinking that most people have not yet done about most of their still unfinished stuff. It will probably be true, too, that the person who needs tires on his car has had that on his radar for quite a while. It's also likely that he's been on his computer hundreds of times, often with just enough time and energy to take that action. Why didn't he do it? Because in that state of mind, the last thing in the world he felt like doing was considering all his projects, including getting tires, and what their next actions were. In those moments, he didn't feel like thinking at all. What he needed was to have already figured those things out. If he gets that next action thinking done, then when he happens to have 15 minutes before a meeting, at his computer, and his energy is about 4.2 out of 10, he can look at the list of things to do and be delighted to see "research new tires" on it. "That's something I can do and complete successfully," he'll think, and then he'll actually be motivated to surf the web about it just to experience the win of completing something useful in the time and energy window he's in. In this context, he'd be incapable of starting a large proposal draft for a client, but he has sufficient resources for searching the internet and getting simple information quickly. It's highly probable that at some point he'll look at a new set of tires on his car and feel on top of the world. Defining what real doing looks like on the most basic level and organizing placeholder reminders that we can trust are master keys to productivity enhancement and creating a relaxed inner environment. Often, even the simplest things are stuck because we haven't made a final decision yet about the next action. People in my seminars often have things on their lists like "get a tune-up for the car." Is "get a tune-up" a next action? Not unless you're walking out to your car with wrench in hand dressed to get greasy. So, what's the next action? I need to take the car to the garage. Oh, yeah, I need to find out if the garage can take it. I guess I need to call the garage and make the appointment. Do you have the number? Darn, no, I don't have the name and number for the garage. Fred recommended that garage to me, and I don't have that information. I knew something was missing in the equation. And that's often what happens with so many things for so many people. We glance at the project, and some part of us thinks, I don't quite have all the pieces between here and there. We know something is missing, but we're not sure what it is, so we quit. So, what's the next action? I need to get the name and phone number. I guess I could get it from Fred. How could you do that? I can email Fred. So the next action really is, email Fred for info regarding the garage. Did you notice how many steps had to be tracked back before we got to the real next action on this project? That's typical. Most people have many things just like that on their lists and on their minds. Why bright people procrastinate the most. It's really the smartest and most sensitive people who have the highest number of undecided things in their lives and on their lists. Why is that? Think of how our bodies respond to the images we hold in our minds. It appears that the nervous system can't tell the difference between a well-imagined thought and reality. To prove this to yourself, picture walking into a food market and approaching the brightly lit fruit and vegetable section. Are you there? Okay, now go to the citrus bins. Oranges, grapefruits, lemons. Now see the big pile of yellow lemons. There's a cutting board and a knife next to them. Take one of those big yellow lemons and cut it in half lengthwise. Smell that citrus smell. It's really juicy, and there's lemon juice trickling onto the board. Now take a half lemon and cut that in half so you have a quarter lemon wedge in your hands. Okay, now, remember how you did this as a kid? Put that quarter of a lemon in your mouth and bite into it. Scrunch. If you played along with me, you probably noticed that the saliva content in your mouth increased at least a bit. Your body was actually trying to process citric acid, and it was just in your mind. If your body responds to the pictures you give it, how are you likely to feel physically when you think about, say, doing your taxes? Are you sending yourself easy, let's go, completion, success, and I'm a winner pictures? Probably not. For just that reason, what kinds of people would logically be the most resistant to being reminded about a project like that? That is, who would procrastinate the most? Of course, it would be the most creative, sensitive, and intelligent people, because their sensitivity and creativity give them the capability to produce in their minds lurid nightmare scenarios about what might be involved in doing the project and all the negative consequences that might occur if it isn't done perfectly. They just freak out in an instant and quit. Who doesn't procrastinate? Often it's the insensitive oafs who just take something and start plodding forward, unaware of all the things that could go wrong. Everyone else tends to get hung up about all kinds of things. Do my taxes. Oh, no, it's not going to be that easy. It's going to be different this year, I'm sure. I saw the forms. They look different. There are probably new rules I'm going to have to figure out. I might have to read all that damn material. Long form, short form, medium form. File together with my partner. File separate. We'll probably want to claim some new deductions. But if we do, we'll have to back them up. And that means we'll need all the receipts. Oh, my God. I don't know if we really have all the receipts we'll need. And what if we didn't have all the receipts, but we claimed the deductions anyway, and we got audited? Audited? Oh, no. Tax fraud. Jail. And so a lot of people psychologically put themselves in jail just glancing at their tax forms, because they're so smart, sensitive, and creative. In my many years of coaching individuals, this pattern has been borne out more times than I can count. Usually it's the brightest and most sophisticated folks who have the most stuck piles in their offices, homes, email, and heads. Most of the executives I work with have at least several big, complex, and amorphous projects stacked either on top of a file cabinet or on a mental shelf. There always seem to be hobgoblin thoughts lurking inside them. If we don't look at or think about the projects, maybe they'll stay quiet. So what's the solution? There's always having a drink. Numb it. Dumb it down. Notice what happens to many people when they get a little alcohol in their brain. It should drop their energy immediately because it's a depressant. Often, though, the energy lifts, at least initially. Why? The alcohol is depressing something. It's shutting down the negative self-talk and uncomfortable visions that are going on in these folks' minds. Of course my energy will increase if I stop depressing myself with overwhelming pictures of not handling something successfully. But the numbing solutions are temporary at best. The stuff doesn't go away. And unfortunately, when we numb ourselves, we can't do it selectively. The source of inspiration and enthusiasm and personal energy also seems to get numbed. Intelligent dumbing down. There is another solution. Intelligently dumbing down your brain by figuring out the next action. You'll invariably feel a relieving of pressure about anything you have a commitment to change or do when you decide on the very next physical action required to move it forward. Nothing essentially will change in the world, but shifting your focus to something that your mind perceives as a doable task will create a real increase in positive energy, direction, and motivation. If you have truly captured all the things that have your attention during the mind sweep, go through the list again now and decide on the single very next action to take on every one of them. Notice what happens to your energy. You are either attracted or repelled by the things on your lists. There isn't any neutral territory. You are either positively drawn toward completing the action or reluctant to think about what it is and resistant to getting involved in it. Often it's simply the next action decision that makes the difference between the two extremes. Thinking and deciding require energy. And when you notice something unfinished in your world, but haven't determined what the next action is yet, you'll tend to be reminded of your fatigue and sense of being overwhelmed. Hence, most people's reaction to their own lists and organizers is negative. Not because of the contents per se, but rather because sufficient appropriate thinking has yet to be applied to them. In following up with people who have begun to implement this methodology, I've discovered that one of the subtler ways many of them fall off the wagon is in letting their action lists grow back into lists of tasks or sub-projects instead of discrete next actions. They're still ahead of most people because they're actually writing things down, but they often find themselves stuck and procrastinating because they've allowed their action lists to harbor items like meeting with the banquet committee, Johnny's birthday, receptionist, slide presentation. In other words, things have morphed back into stuff instead of starting at the action level. There are no clear next actions here, and anyone keeping a list filled with items like this would send her brain into overload every time she looked at it. Is this extra work? Is figuring out the next action on your commitments additional effort that you don't need to expend? No, of course not. If you need to get your car tuned, for instance, you're going to have to figure out that next action at some point anyway. The problem is that most people wait to do it until the next action is call the auto club for tow truck. So when do you think most people really make a lot of their next action decisions about their stuff? When it shows up or when it blows up? And do you think there might be a difference in the quality of their lives if they handled this knowledge work on the front end instead of the back? Which do you think is the more efficient way to move through life? Deciding next actions on your projects as soon as they appear on your radar screen, and then efficiently grouping them into categories of actions that you get done in certain uniform contexts? Or avoiding thinking about what exactly needs to be done until it has to be done, then sputtering through your actions as you try to catch up and put out the fires? That may sound exaggerated, but when I ask groups of people to estimate when most of the action decisions are made in their companies, with few exceptions, they say, when things blow up. One of our global corporate clients surveyed its population about sources of stress in its culture, and the number one complaint was the last-minute crisis work consistently promoted by team leaders who failed to make appropriate decisions on the front end. The value of a next action decision-making standard. I have had several sophisticated senior executives tell me that installing "what's the next action" as an operational standard in their organization was transformative in terms of measurable performance output. It changed their culture permanently and significantly for the better. Why? Because the question forces clarity, accountability, productivity, and empowerment. Clarity. Too many discussions end with only a vague sense that people know what they have decided and are going to do. But without a clear conclusion that there is a next action, much less what it is and who's got it, more often than not, a lot of stuff gets left up in the air. I am frequently asked to facilitate meetings. I've learned the hard way that no matter where we are in the conversation, 20 minutes before the agreed end time of the discussion, I must force the question. So, what's the next action here? In my experience, there is usually 20 minutes worth of clarifying and sometimes tough decisions still required to come up with an answer. This is radical common sense. Radical because it often compels discussion at deeper levels than people are comfortable with. Are we serious about this? Do we really know what we're doing here? Are we really ready to allocate precious time and resources to this? It's very easy to avoid these more relevant levels of thinking. What prevents those issues from slipping away into amorphous stuff is forcing the decision about the next action. Some further conversation, exploration, deliberation, and negotiation are often needed to put the topic to rest. The world is too unpredictable these days to permit assumptions about outcomes. We need to take responsibility for moving things to clarity. You have to have some experience of this to really know what I mean here. If you do, you're probably saying to yourself, yes. If you're not sure what I'm talking about, I suggest that in your next meeting with anyone, you end the conversation with the question, so what's the next action here? Then notice what happens. Accountability. The dark side of collaborative cultures is the allergy they foster to holding anyone responsible for having the ball. Mine or yours is unfortunately not in the common vocabulary of many such organizations. There is a sense that that would be impolite. We're all in this together is a worthy sentiment, but seldom a reality in the hard-nosed day-to-day world of work. Too many meetings end with a vague feeling among the players that something ought to happen and the hope that it's not their personal job to make it so. The way I see it, what's truly impolite is allowing people to walk away from discussions unclear. Real togetherness of a group is reflected by the responsibility that all take for defining the real things to do and the specific people assigned to do them, so everyone is freed of the angst of still undecided actions. Again, if you've been there, you'll know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, test it out. Take a small risk and ask, "So what's the next action on this?" at the end of each discussion point in your next staff meeting, or in your next family conversation around the dinner table. Productivity. Organizations naturally become more productive when they model and train front-end next action decision-making. For all the reasons mentioned, determining the required physical allocation of resources necessary to make something happen as soon as the outcome has been clarified will produce more results sooner and with less effort. Learning to break through the barriers of the sophisticated creative thinking that can freeze activity, that is, the entangled mental webs we spin, is a superior skill. Productivity has been touted for decades as a desirable thing to improve in organizations. Anything that can help maximize output will do that. But in the world of knowledge work, all the computers and telecom improvements and leadership seminars on the planet will make no difference in this regard unless the individuals involved increase their operational responsiveness. And that requires thinking about something that lands in your world before you have to. One of the biggest productivity leaks I have seen in some organizations is the lack of next actions determined for long-term projects. Long-term does not mean someday maybe. Those projects with distant goal lines are still to be done as soon as possible. Long-term simply means more action steps until it's done. Not, no need to decide next actions because the day of reckoning is so far away. When every project and open loop in an organization is being monitored, it's a whole new ballgame. Empowerment. Perhaps the greatest benefit of adopting the next action approach is that it dramatically increases your ability to make things happen with a concomitant rise in your self-esteem and constructive outlook. People are constantly doing things, but usually only when they have to, under fire from themselves or others. They get no sense of winning or of being in control or of cooperating among themselves and with their world. People are starving for those experiences. The daily behaviors that define the things that are incomplete and the moves that are needed to complete them must change. Getting things going of your own accord, before you're forced to by external pressure and internal stress, builds a firm foundation of self-worth that will spread to every aspect of your life. You are the captain of your own ship. The more you act from that perspective, the better things will go for you. Asking yourself, what's the next action, undermines the victim mentality. It presupposes that there is a possibility of change and that there is something you can do to make it happen. That is the assumed affirmation in the behavior. And these kinds of assumed affirmations often work more fundamentally to build a positive self-image than can repeating, "I am a powerful, effective person making things happen in my life," 1,000 times. Is there too much complaining in your culture? The next time someone moans about something, try asking, "So what's the next action?" People will complain only about something that they assume could be better than it currently is. The action question forces the issue. If it can be changed, there's some action that will change it. If it can't, it must be considered part of the landscape to be incorporated in strategy and tactics. Complaining is a sign that someone isn't willing to risk moving on a changeable situation, or won't consider the immutable circumstance in his or her plans. This is a temporary and hollow form of self-validation. Although my colleagues and I rarely promote our work in this way, I notice people really empowering themselves every day as we coach them in applying the next action technique. It increases the light in their eyes and the lightness in their step, and a sparkle shows up in their thinking and demeanor. We are all already powerful, but deciding on and effectively managing the physical actions required to move things forward seems to exercise that power in ways that call forward the more positive aspects of our nature. When you start to make things happen, you begin to believe that you can make things happen. And that makes things happen. Chapter 13. The Power of Outcome Focusing. The power of directing our mental and imaginative processes to create change has been studied and promoted in thousands of contexts, from early positive thinking books to recent discoveries in advanced neurophysiology. My own interest has been in applying the principle in terms of practical reality. Does it help get things done? And if so, how do we best utilize it in managing the work of our lives? Can we really use this information in ways that allow us to produce what we want to have happen with less effort? The answer has been a resounding yes. Focus and the fast track. Over the years, I have seen the application of the method presented in this book create profound results for people in their day-to-day worlds. As you begin to use it habitually as your primary means of addressing all situations, from processing emails, to buying a house or a company, to structuring meetings or having conversations with your kids, your personal productivity can go through the roof. Many of the professionals I have worked with who integrated this method now find themselves experiencing enhanced or even new jobs, careers, and lifestyles. These processes really work in the arena of the ordinary things we must deal with daily, the stuff of our work. When you demonstrate to yourself and to others an increasing ability to get things done in the trenches, you probably won't stay in the same trench for very long. Of course, those attracted to implementing getting things done are usually already on a self-development path and don't assume that they'll be doing the same things a year from now that they're doing now anyway. But they love the fact that this method gets them there faster and more easily. It's interesting to note that the people who need this methodology the least are usually the ones who engage with it the quickest and the most. That puzzled me for a while until I realized that one of the most important results of its implementation is the relief of drag, as in retarding force. Who is the most interested in that? Those who are the most invested in moving themselves forward quickly and easily. It's been inspiring for me to learn and coach others how to deal with the immediate realities down where the rubber meets the road, and how to tie in the power of positive imagery to practical experiences in all our daily lives. The fast track alluded to here is a bit of a misnomer. For some, slowing down, getting out of the squirrel cage, and taking care of themselves may be the major change precipitated by this methodology. An interesting phenomenon I have noticed more than once is that for some highly energetic people, incorporating the getting things done mindset turbocharges their busy and creative lifestyle to a new level of discomfort. Now I can really get a lot more done and faster. And they then take the opportunity for healthy self-examination about how important that really is versus more quality of life kinds of outcomes they may crave. The bottom line is it makes you more conscious, more focused, and more capable of implementing the changes and results you want, whatever they are. Create a way to spend more time with my daughter is as specific a project as any, and equally demanding of a next action to be determined. Having the vague, gnawing sense that you should do something about your relationship with your daughter and not actually doing anything can be a killer. I often work with people who are willing to acknowledge the real things of their lives at this level as incompletes, to write them down, define real projects about them, and ensure that next actions are decided on until the finish line is crossed. That is real productivity, perhaps in its most awesome manifestation. The significance of applied outcome thinking. What I want to emphasize now is how learning to process the details of our work and lives with this clear and consistent system can affect us and others in significant ways we may not expect. As I've said, employing next action decision-making results in clarity, productivity, accountability, and empowerment. Exactly the same results happen when you hold yourself to the discipline of identifying the real results you want, and more specifically, the projects you need to define in order to produce them. It's all connected.